You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
Thomas Melvin Tall, and I was born in Los Angeles on June the 10th, 1940. The reason June the 10th, 1940 is fairly significant is because on June the 10th, 1876, my grandmother was born. And on June the 10th, 1909, my mother was born. And on June the 10th, 1934, my sister Carolyn was born. And on June the 10th, 1940, I was born. And on June the 10th, 2015, my grandson Mac was born. When I was young and my mother and my grandmother and my sister were all alive, they've all passed away, we had a big celebration on June the 10th. So it was pretty exciting as a young boy growing up, having that to look forward to.
Tom Tall has a remarkable story. His journey began in the hills of Los Angeles. He eventually landed at Snow College before being drafted into the Army and stationed in Germany. He graduated Brigham Young University at the age of 33 and traveled all over the Western United States selling Western wear. As an expert salesman, he has overcome many obstacles and experienced a variety of fascinating jobs. He met and married his lovely wife, Dorothy, and together they have five amazing kids. He and Dorothy have worked so hard to provide a beautiful life for their family and the home that they've lived in for over 40 years. His unwavering faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ has been a cornerstone through his extraordinary life. His story begins with his parents, who got their start just before the Great Depression hit.
So my mom and dad were both born and raised in Utah. My dad's from Bluffdale, Riverton, but my mother was from Mount Pleasant, and her parents were fairly well off, and she went to the University of Utah. Well, my mother was well educated, and my father had no education, maybe the eighth grade, and they eloped to Evanston, Wyoming, and got married. I think my grandmother and my grandfather, who I never met, were not very happy about my mother and dad eloping to Evanston, and then the Depression came along. They had my two older sisters, and my dad couldn't find work. And so he would travel all over the United States on trains. Wherever he could hear that there was work, he would go. And as a result, my mother dropped out of school. In her senior year at the University of Utah, she was just like one semester away from graduating, and she never did graduate. And she felt bad about that. But then my parents heard that there was employment in Southern California, so they moved to Los Angeles, and they were not active in the church. But shortly after they had moved to Los Angeles, one day, a fellow by the name of John Russin, who was a very active member of the church, drove by, saw a car with a Utah license plate in front of a house. The church was not very strong in Southern California in the 30s. It was just starting. He went up and knocked on the door, introduced himself to my parents, and I guess got assigned to be their home teacher, and brought them back into the church. And so when I was born, they were very active. And so as a result, I grew up in Eagle Rock, but our ward was a part of the Glendale Stake in Southern California. And I was raised actively all my life in the church. But thanks to John Russin, got my parents going. My mother was a stay-at-home mother, although she got a job selling to young girls who, in those days, a lot of young girls would have what they called hope chests. Before they were married, they would start filling it up with the things that they thought they would need for a wedding. So my mother was selling silverware and crystal and things like that. So she had a little part-time job, but my dad worked for Southern California Edison, where he stayed for the rest of his life with Southern California Edison, just working for the big utility company. I don't think he ever made over $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 a year growing up. And so we lived modestly. We had gardens in our house, and my grandmother moved down there with them a couple of years after we got there. For the first 3 or 4 years, I lived in a little house on Las Colinas in Eagle Rock. And then my mother and my father and my grandmother bought a big house in Eagle Rock on Sierra Villa. And my grandmother lived in the basement, and my parents and I lived on a big piece of property in an old house. It was built in 1920 or so. And so that's where I was raised with my four siblings. I have two older sisters, Sammy Lane, and my sister Clarilyn. We're both older than I was. And then I had two younger brothers. My older sisters got married when I was maybe 10 years old, about 1950. And then it was just the three boys. And we raised rabbits in the backyard. It started with my oldest sister won a rabbit at some type of a contest. I can't remember. And by the time that I was 12 or 13 or 14 years old, we had hundreds of rabbits in our backyard. And one of the things that was one of my jobs was to go out on Thursday and Friday afternoons and take orders for Sunday dinner rabbits. And I would go out to the neighbors, and then my dad would kill the rabbits, dress them out on Saturday, and then I'd go deliver them. And we used that money for two things, for school clothes and also for summer camps. We went to YMCA summer camp up in the San Bernardino Mountains, and my brother Larry and I really looked forward to it. We went to the lakes, we went horseback riding, and we did all sorts of crafts and swimming and hiking, and it was a great experience, and it's something that we really remember. My brother Larry and I, and we're very close now, we fought a lot, but I guess we were pretty close, but we got into it on a regular basis. One time we got into a big fight, and we ended up falling through a big plate glass window, and our mother was so mad at us that she wouldn't take us to the hospital. I had a cut on the bottom of my foot that needed stitches on it, and my brother had a cut on the back of his shoulder. And so we both had to call our friends to come and take us to the emergency hospital to get stitches, because my mother had been telling us for 15 or 20 or 30 minutes to knock it off, and we wouldn't. But we're very close now. I've been very close to both my brothers all my life. One of the early childhood memories I have is that because my parents didn't have a lot of money, we didn't take exotic vacations. But one of the things that we would do on a fairly regular basis is when I was quite young, we would go to San Diego and go down, and our parents would take us to the zoo. And when I was about 5 years old, my grandfather, who I had never met before, was not well and probably was not going to live much longer. And I remember at about the age of 5 years going downtown Los Angeles and getting on a bus with, I think, my mother and father, and riding up to Salt Lake for my dad to basically say goodbye to his father and introduce his father to my dad's first son, which was me. I was about 10 years old. My mother's mother is from Manti. And in about 1950, she had an aunt who passed away. And my mother and my grandmother bought this little house in Manti, Utah. So starting in 1950, my brothers and sisters and I would spend every summer in Manti. So as soon as school was out, around the middle of June, we would pack up the car and we would all drive up to Manti. And so I have a lot of childhood memories of working on the farms in Manti. I had a friend that had a dairy farm, and I'd work there. And I had another really close friend by the name of Doug Keeler. And his dad had a big farm, and they had horses. And so my brothers and I would look forward to going up there every summer from about 1950 until I was about 18, Manti has a lot of memories for me. I spent a lot of time down in Manti. And one of the memories that sticks out and is still repeated among my siblings is the time that I borrowed my mother's car. We would come up and spend the summers there. And I wasn't old enough to have a driver's license, but for some reason or another, my mother would let me take the car. But that wasn't all that unusual in Manti because a lot of kids drove tractors and farm equipment. And one day I borrowed my mother's car. And my friend Doug Keeler was cutting hay down on one of their farms west of Manti. And so I decided to go down and visit with him. But at age 15, I thought I was a good driver, but I was driving way too fast. And they were all dirt roads. And I went around a corner and I rolled the car into a ditch. And Doug's father was actually out there with him cutting hay. And Doug said, "Dad, we got to go help Tom. His car's in the ditch and rolled over." And his dad said, "If that kid's dumb enough to drive around that corner and roll the car, he can figure it out his own way." And so he didn't come to help. But fortunately, somebody else came along on a tractor and pulled me out of the ditch. But the problem was there was a big dent in the side of the car on the passenger side. Well, I took the car home, and my older sister was Sammy Lane, my oldest sister, was with us that summer in Manti, and she did have a driver's license. And that day, nobody discovered the dent in the side of the car. So the next day, we all decided there's a little lake just outside of Manti. It's called Palisade Lake. And we would go up there to do fishing and to have picnics and things. And so she drove my brothers and I up to Lake Palisade. And there's a lot of trees there. And I was sitting on the passenger's side in the front seat. And as she drove by one of these close trees, I whacked the side of the car. And I said, "Sammy Lane, you just hit this car." And we all got out and looked. And sure enough, there was a big dent in the side of the car. And I got away with it because nobody ever discovered it at the time. And my sister took the rap for putting the dent in the car. But many, many years later, of course, I admitted it. So that's one of the memories that I have, because whenever we would get together, they would always say, "Tell us about the time that you wrecked the car and blamed it on Sammy Lane." So the other memories of Manti were I spent one summer working on a dairy farm just outside of Manti, not too far from Palisade Lake. We'd get up and milk 60 cows in the morning and then go out and haul hay all day long and then come back in the evening and milk 60 cows. But there were a lot of fun times. And then we would always go down to the park and go swimming. And so Manti has a lot of fun memories. All my brothers and sisters and I went to the same elementary school. We walked every day to the same elementary school. It was not very far away, maybe about a mile. And then we all went to the same junior high and high school, which was all part of the same school. It wasn't two separate schools. The junior high and the high school were in the same physical building. And there we walked about a mile and a half or 2 miles to school every day. It was Southern California, so of course we didn't have snow. My closest friend and my close friend to this day moved in 1945 or 1946 as my next-door neighbor, and we stayed in close touch all these years. His name was Alan Eisenbach, who was a Jewish boy that moved in next door to us, and we have been like brothers, and my brother Larry as well with Alan, and our streets ran right up to the hills, and so as a young boy, we spent every summer walking through the hills and finding caves.
Despite his happy childhood, high school was not an easy time for Tom.
My name was Tom Tall, and as a senior, starting my senior in high school, I was 5'3" and I weighed 100 pounds. I was the last one when we were playing in the neighborhoods and things, the last one to be picked for the basketball, because I was just a little shrimp. I didn't start to grow until my senior year in high school. So what it did was it made me a smart aleck, because I think that I spent a lot of time in high school because I was so small, being sarcastic, which has not served me very well in my life. But I had another friend in high school. His name was Stuart Roop, who became very close friends. And he was about as short as I was. And we were both loudmouths in school. And we played games and football on the streets, but I never played for the school or anything like that. I got pretty darn good at playing ping pong. Alan Eisenbach had a ping pong table in his basement, and we would spend hours and hours playing ping pong. So that was about as wild a sport as I ever got involved in. I was the intercollegiate doubles champ at Snow College in ping pong. That's no big deal. But somehow or another, we got through it. My graduating class had 118, by today's standards, really small. And in Los Angeles, they had both winter graduating classes and summer graduating classes. Depending on how old you were, you would either start school in September or you would start school in February at the second semester. And because of my age, I started junior high school in February and ended up graduating from Eagle Rock High School in February of 1958. But I think it was my friend Doug Keeler, who was from Manti, and I think he's the one that probably talked me into going to Snow College, which turned out to be a great thing. When I went to Snow College, there was only 200 or 300 students in the entire school back in the 1950s and early 1960s. You knew everybody in the school. Snow College is just in Ephraim, just 7 miles north of Manti. And so I actually had one of my teachers that would pick me up in the morning and drive to school. I get started, and I had 2 years, and I had an associate degree. And then I got drafted in September of 61. All three brothers, I got drafted in 1961. My brother Larry, who is a year and 9 months younger than I am, actually signed up, volunteered for the draft about a year earlier. He ended up going to Hawaii. My youngest brother, Kenny, he ended up in the Army, ended up in Vietnam, and ended up being shot through the left side of his head when he had only been in Vietnam for about 6 weeks. When he was shot, and they didn't expect him to live, but he ended up being totally paralyzed on the right side of his body, and being shot in the left side of the head creates a condition called aphasia, where you lose your memory and you lose your ability to remember words. And he's gotten much better now. I was drafted on September the 25th, 1961. And went to Fort Ord, California for basic training, and then was sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia. And I went through signal school. And when I completed signal school, then I was sent to Southern Germany. And after the government had spent a lot of money in training me in Morse code and all the things to do with the signal corps, when I got over there, there were too many people that had the same qualifications in the particular place where I was stationed. And so I ended up in the motor pool. But it turned out to be a good experience. And this was in 1962 by the time I got to Southern Germany. And we were called up because of the Berlin crisis, which happened in 1961. But being in the motor pool, the really fun part about that was that they asked us whether we had Army driver's licenses, which we did not have. And we were in Southern Germany, very close to right on the borders of the Black Forest. And so every day for 6 weeks, we would get in trucks and jeeps and drive all through the Black Forest to hone our skills on driving big trucks and small vehicles and things. Turned out to be a great experience, and I really enjoyed it.
By September of 1963, Tom had returned home from Germany and was living with his parents in Southern California. It was during this time that he took a wide variety of very interesting jobs.
The very first job was just a job loading trucks at night with produce. And I actually went to work for three different finance companies, but I ended up with General Motors Company, and it was repossessing cars. And the reason what really appealed to me about that was that they gave you a car, and I didn't have enough money to buy my own car. So now I have a job with a car, and a lot of freedom. And so I was repossessing cars at night. I would go out and I had a whole set of master keys. And when somebody would get behind on their payments, I'd go steal their car at night. So on several times, I had people catch me trying to steal their car. And one time a guy came out with a pistol and I just said, you can have the car. And another time a guy came with a rifle and threatened to shoot me. But I said, once again, you can have the car. But I remember one time some of my friends really wanted to go with me to steal cars at night. And so one time we were down in East Los Angeles and the car was beside the house down a long driveway. And in the middle of it, a big guy came out and he caught us. But my friend was there with me and he was pretty good. And I thought, gosh, he's going to help me talk my way out of this mess. But he jumped in the car and locked both doors. And so there I was stuck with. Anyway, there was a lot of fun stories, but I liked it and it had a lot of freedom and General Motors was a good company. And then when Dorothy married me, I had a paper route. But it wasn't just a regular paper route. I had about 350 customers up in the Hollywood Hills and I delivered papers to a lot of the movie stars and Johnny Mathis and Ozzy and Harriet and David Nelson and all the stars up through there. And it was a really good job. I had a little convertible and it took me a couple hours every afternoon. So when Dorothy, we always tease her that she had graduated from BYU and she'd married a paper boy. My friend Doug Keeler from Manti was importing cars from Germany, Volkswagens, and he had a friend that happened to be Dorothy's roommate who had ordered one of his cars from him and asked me to take the car over. But I got to know her, and so she invited me to a mutual activity one night where she had invited Dorothy and a few of her roommates from BYU. And I came over and we had a little dinner at her house. And then we all went to theater in the round as part of a mutual activity in the San Fernando Valley in Southern California, where we saw Anna Maria Alberghetti in West Side Story. And Dorothy and I sat next to each other and we really enjoyed the music together. And she still laughs because I was trying to figure out a way to get her phone number, and I asked her if she knew how to get back to the freeway, and that's why she always says, of course, I got here, I'm sure I can get home. Dorothy had a lot of dates, had a lot of boyfriends, but somehow or another, she was still single and teaching school in Orange County, and we met then, and dated for about 9 months and got married the following July. I would say we were quite attracted to one another, and it didn't take long for me to think that this was the right one. I called up my mother and I said, I think I've found the girl I'm going to marry, Mother. And when I introduced her to Dorothy, she agreed. My mother loved Dorothy. And Dorothy's mom and dad liked me. So we got married in July of 1965. She was absolutely a drop-dead beautiful girl, absolutely beautiful. And she was so kind, and everybody loved her. And she loved the children. And yeah, she was solid in the church, and she got cold feet. We actually had set our wedding date for June the 25th of 1965. And one day I went to her house, and she says, I'm not so sure I want to get married. So I was brokenhearted. And we broke up a couple of times for, close to a day. Not for very long, very short periods of time. But anyway, I had planned on getting married on June the 25th, but I apparently convinced her to change her mind. And so we just postponed it another month. But we got married on July the 30th, 1965, went on a honeymoon. I borrowed an old girlfriend's father's camper. And we did our honeymoon. The first night we stayed in a hotel on the beach in Malibu, California, but then the rest of the honeymoon was in this old camper. And we drove up the coast to San Francisco, stopped at San Simeon, then came back. In the meantime, we had rented a little apartment house in North Hollywood, California. And went to the Studio City ward, which just was about a block down the street on the same street that we were on in Riverside Drive. So those were fun days. And we were young. I was 25. Dorothy was 24. And she was teaching school. And I was still trying to figure out what the heck I was going to do, and had every intention on going back to school. But I did not when I got out of the Army and I met Dorothy. And we got married. And so I started doing a lot of different things. I eventually became a stockbroker. I moved right after we got married. While I was still with General Motors, John Huntsman Sr., the people that everybody know that was the billionaire here in Utah, he was in our ward in California, and he hired me to go to work for his company. And he was working for his two uncles, which was Olson Brother Eggs. And so they hired me to be a manager of an egg company. It was actually a processing plant. So I started with John Huntsman in Olson Brother Eggs. First job was in Santa Ana, California, and then from there, Phoenix, Arizona, and then they moved me to San Diego. That's about the time I decided to become a stockbroker. I don't know exactly how it happened, but I applied with Payne Weber Jackson and Curtis, became a stockbroker. And Michael was born in November of 1968. While I was in New York, working for Payne Weber Jackson and Curtis, I was back there going to a school that they had sponsored. It was a good experience. I loved New York City. I loved going to the school. So I lived on the corner of 42nd and 2nd Street, which is right near the United Nations. There were a whole bunch of us that were in the school, and the company put us all up in this hotel in Tudor City, which is just a section of New York City. And then we would take the subway down to Wall Street every day, which is where the firm was, and we're in school all day long. And so Dorothy had the baby by herself. I think my brother's wife took her to the hospital, and I got a call in New York saying Dorothy's had a baby. Of course, we knew the baby was imminent. And fortunately, Payne Weber Jackson Curtis flew me home for the weekend, and I came down to see the baby, which was Michael. That was very exciting times. And then went back to New York and finished the school. And when I came home, about a month later, I had contacted the Hong Kong flu, which was a big deal in the late 1968. And so Dorothy had just come home with a brand new baby, and I came home very sick. And as a result, had to move in with my mom and dad because she had a brand new baby and she wasn't about to let me come home with this Hong Kong flu and expose her and the baby. I did come home, but I can't remember how long I stayed with my folks, but probably a couple of weeks. I was really sick. I was sick when I took the exams. I didn't think I'd even pass the exams. I was so sick. But they had it scheduled and you had to take it, and I did pass. And so that's what happened. And our son Matthew was born a couple of years later in 1970. And by that time, I had left Payne Weber Jackson and Curtis, and we were up in Newhall, California. I had left the stock brokerage business and went to work for a partnership with some friends in Santa Clarita, California, in a furniture and appliance store. But by about 1971, one day came home to Dorothy. We had two boys at the time, and said, "What do you think about going back to BYU?" And she was 100% in favor of it. She had to go back and start teaching school again to help get through. But when we went back to BYU, we had two little boys. My mother and I hopped in her car and drove to Provo and found a little three-bedroom house right on Kitty Corner from Kiwanis Park on, 11th East and 820 North. It was a delightful little house, $160 a month for a three-bedroom house. Pretty good deal in those days. Because I had had the furniture and appliance business, I brought new carpeting, and we fixed up the house the way we liked it. So we moved up there, and Dorothy got a job teaching. We moved up, and she had no job. And I had the GI Bill, and she had to go out and apply with the Alpine School District, and they offered her a full-time job at Grove Crest Elementary, which is in Pleasant Grove. And so we went out and looked in the newspaper, and there was this lady that was offering babysitting. And we went over and talked to her. Her name was Mrs. Tarr, and her husband was a associate professor up at BYU, and they were poor as we were. And so we had the two little boys, and we asked her how much she would charge to babysit for them if we bring them in, drop them off about 8 o'clock in the morning, pick them up about 5 in the evening. And it was $3 a day for both of them, including lunch. So it was a great deal for us. And she was wonderful. And so the two little boys were well taken care of during the day. And then Dorothy would come home from school, and I was at BYU all day. And so those were good days too. So we were there for 2 years. We loved Provo. We loved our little ward in Provo. And we would take the boys to the basketball and the football games. They were just little boys, 2 and 3 years old. And we had a neighbor who loved our kids, and it was good times. Graduating in finance, and I thought that, you know, I checked around with a lot of companies and interviewed with several companies in Utah, but in those days, the wages were, what they were offering was not very much money. And I just stopped by my friends up in Newhall, where I had worked. This family, and their name were the McKeons, and they had the furniture and appliance store that I was a partner with in on one part of their family. And another part of their family had a Western wear store. And when I stopped by just to say hello and visit, they said, there's a fellow from Wrangler that's looking for a salesman for selling West cowboy boots. You ought to give him a call. So I did call him, and we got together, and they were offering a lot more money than anybody else that I had been interviewing with. And so I was hired by Wrangler. Wrangler had two divisions in their Western boots, the Wrangler boots, which was what in those days was referred to as popular price boot, inexpensive boots, and they had a very expensive line. And so my job was to call on the Western stores all through Southern California, plus the JCPenney stores. And so I started off with Wrangler. They had 28 salesmen in the United States, and they started me off at $15,000 a year, and they paid all my expenses. And that was more than $5,000 or $6,000 a year, more than any other job being offered to me. But Wrangler was not a popular boot at the time in Southern California. There was another company called Acme Boot Company that was in the same price line as mine, and they owned almost all the business. So it was tough. The first year was really tough. But I was out there doing better than the previous salesman had done. And within 5 years, I had become the number one salesman for Wrangler in the entire United States. So I had taken the business from practically nothing to doing very well. They would send out a letter to all the salesmen every week. They would show how many boots that you sold for the week and who's the number one salesman for the week. And week after week after week, I was number 28 out of 28. I'm brand new in the business, never sold a cowboy boot in my life. There was no big demand for Wrangler boots in Southern California. It was all Acme boots. And so every place I would go, the Acme salesman would go in there, and he'd have 10 or 15 styles that the store would carry. And I was trying to get 2 or 3 into the store that they would sell. So week after week, 28, 28, 28. But within 5 years, I was number one. And at that point, then other people became interested and was started offering me jobs. And so I eventually made a change, but it was a great way to start. And we bought a VA repossession, a lovely 5-bedroom home that had been damaged extensively by an earthquake in 1971, and it had been damaged to the extent that the people had to move out of it, and the VA, which had financed the house in the first place, had come in and put it all back together and rebuilt it and painted it and new carpets and everything. And so we bought that house. It was $31,500. It required a total of about $1,500 as a down payment, which included the down payment and the closing costs on the house, of which I had to borrow $1,000 from my brother-in-law to get into it. And the payments were $305 a month, which included the taxes and the insurance on the house. And we thought, we have absolutely lost our minds, $305 a month for our house. And but I did well with Wrangler, and the $300 turned out not to be a big problem. And 8 years later, we sold the house for $133,000 and moved to Utah to this house.
The move to Utah came a few years after leaving Wrangler and starting a new opportunity with Santa Rosa Shoe Company.
It was more money than I had ever dreamed of making at the time. And so I switched over from Wrangler Boots and went to work for them. And then I was with them for 3 years in Southern California. And they asked me one day if I had any interest in transferring with them to Utah. And so we came up here, and this home was in the process of being built. It wasn't even finished. And we came up here and bought this house in 1981. And so we've been here for 41 years now. We had all five children, and the youngest was Megan, and she had been born in 1979. So we moved here in 1981. So she was 2 years old. And Michael and Matthew were just starting junior high school. And Megan wasn't old enough to go to school, but Michelle and Marty were starting elementary school.
It wasn't too long after their relocation to Utah that Tom left the Santa Rosa Shoe Company.
I left them 5 years later, up 3 years down there and 2 years up here. And then I went to work for Chick Jeans, which was, I'm still selling the same customers, but now I'm in the denim business. I was actually doing just fine with them, but they just said, we're just going to consolidate territories. And they called me up the night before Thanksgiving, my boss did. And it's the only time I've ever been let go of a job. After Chick Jeans, then I did a bunch of things. You know, it was all sales related, and I picked up some other lines, and I was calling. I mean, I was making some money, but I was just getting by. Fortunately, Dorothy was teaching school, and we've never had a financial problem. When I say a problem, I mean we've never bounced a check. We've never not been able to pay our bills. We've always gotten by just fine. And then Bill called me. He said, my company is telling me I have to hire somebody as an assistant. And I was between jobs. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. And because we were really good friends, but my nearest manager was 1,000 miles away from me. And I was 100% on my own. So now I'm with Bill, who's 3 blocks away from me. And I just said, I can't take this any longer. Going to work for a close friend is a bad idea. About a year or so later, I got a phone call from a Western boot company that my brother had worked for. And so I knew some of the same people. And he called just out of the blue. I can remember even the room I was in when I took the phone call in. And he called me up and he said, would you be interested in... And it was a great job with a Laredo boot company. And so went with him, and then they went out of business, unfortunately. But there was somebody else that in the meantime that wanted me. And so I went back into the Western boot business. And then one of my friends, I was someplace with him, and he said, I just went to work for another company. And he said, I have a little sidelines. So sidelines are, if you work for a major company like I did and selling these things, a sideline would be like, for example, I'm selling cowboy boots, but somebody says, I have a little straw hat line. You know, you're calling on these customers anyway. Would you like to sell this? This guy, a friend of mine, says, I just got hired by Chippewa Boot Company, and I have a little sideline called Old Friend Slippers. They're made in China, but they're from Australian shearling inside. And he says, I'm not making a lot of money on it, but he says, I'm making enough money to pay for my gas and things along the line. He says, and this new company will not let me keep a sideline. Would you like a little sideline while you're calling on your customers? You can sell them some shearling slippers. So I took the job. At the time, it was a 10% line. That means you got a 10% commission. Territory was doing about $35,000 a year. Total, $35,000 a year. So you're making 10%, which is $3,500 a year. But $3,500 a year pay for my gas. So I get this little line, and I take it from $35,000 a year to $1,250,000 a year at 10% commission. So now I have a little sideline that I'm making over $100,000 a year just as of my sideline. It's not even my main job. So friend says, you want to take this little job? And so all of a sudden, if you work hard and you're a good salesman, that's great. But if you have a terrific line, it's just luck. I was pretty much an absentee father, not by choice, but by profession. I was gone a lot. I would take off on Monday morning and not get home until Friday evening or Thursday evening or Friday evening for most of my career. Now, when we got up here, there were a lot of times when I could work in Utah and around the area and come home at night. But I missed most of my children's important events. I missed a lot of birthdays. I missed a lot of school activities. And it was just the way it is. The job that I had required being on the road. I mean, I had Utah, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. And later on, when most of them were gone, I added Colorado, Oregon, and Washington. So I would get in the car, went on Oregon, Washington trips, and be gone for 2 weeks at a time. So the success of my five children go about 99% to their mother. And she was a full-time school teacher. I mean, she had a big challenge. She was working full-time and coming home at night and fixing meals. But it was hard being gone all the time from the kids and from Dorothy and giving all that responsibility to her.
Outside of work and family life, Tom had a love for flying airplanes. He was able to pursue this hobby starting way back in his Studio City days.
We moved into the Studio City ward in the San Fernando Valley, and I had a good friend who became our home teacher, and he lived just down the street, and he had just started his chiropractic business. And one day, when I was in there visiting with him, he said, Tom, let's buy an airplane. And he said, I have a friend that has told me about an airplane that we can buy for $700. And I said, really? And I had taken a couple of lessons in an airplane. And so I was kind of interested in airplanes. And that's probably the reason this came up. But we bought a little 1941 Aronca Chief for $700. It was a lot of fun. And that's how I learned to fly. I bought a plane before I could fly it and hired an instructor who charged us about $10 an hour to teach us how to fly, which is very reasonable today. But it was a plane that in order to start it, you had to get out and take the propeller and crank it down to start it. What it's called is propping it. So you just get a hold of the propeller and you pull down on it and it starts. And the gas tank was right in front of the windshield, and it consisted of a cork in the gas tank with a coat hanger that was painted red, and crimped at the top. And when the tank was full, the cork would be, of course, at the top. And as you would fly along and use the gas, the cork would come down. One day, my friend, who was a partner with me on the airplane, told me that he had just taken a trip up to the San Bernardino Mountains to Lake Big Bear. And he said, it's a wonderful flight. And I was really excited about that. And by that time, I was a private pilot. And so I flew up there and I asked him, did we have plenty of gas to make the trip up from the San Fernando Valley to Big Bear Lake? And he said, yeah, there was plenty of gas. So when I got up there, it was such a beautiful day that I decided to land. And Big Bear Airport is at 7,000 feet. Well, when you're at 7,000 feet and you land and then have to take off again on a hot day, you use a lot more fuel. So it was an experience that I've never forgotten, because about halfway back to the airport, the cork was way down. I started getting worried. By the time I got to the airport and went to fill up the tank, I had 0.3 gallon left. We had a friend that taught us how to fly, and he said, there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots. But I learned my lesson. But that was one of the stories that the kids still ask about, the 1941 Aronca Chief. It would only fly at about 80 miles an hour. When we'd fly along the freeway, the cars would pass you by. You couldn't even keep up with the cars on the freeway. So, but it was great fun. And then I eventually started flying bigger and better airplanes. So I did a lot of flying, and we brought the kids up here, Dorothy and I, and a couple of our children. We would fly up to Salt Lake. And so I flew all over Southern California and Nevada and Utah. But I've always loved flying. And my neighbor across the street, Alan Borg, built an airplane in his garage right across the street. And I helped him work on that plane and build it. And then when he was flying it, why, we would fly around here in California and all around.
Flying around the western United States is just one example of the many adventures that have filled Tom's life. He and Dorothy have been all over the world, but the place that they can't get enough of is Hawaii. Throughout their life together, they've been dozens of times and feel that it's a sort of second home.
My friend, his name was Curtis Howard. One day I walked into his office and he said, Tom, there's an advertisement in the newspaper to go to Hawaii for about $400 a person, and it included airfare and a hotel for 7 days in Waikiki. And I said, man, that's something I would love to do. I'd never been to Hawaii, and nor had Dorothy. So we decided we would surprise our wives, and we told them that we were going to take them on a long weekend vacation. But in the meantime, we both arranged for babysitting. In this case, it was Dorothy's mom and dad that came and babysat for us. And so we picked up the girls, and they kept saying, well, where are we going? So we got out on the curb, we got unloaded our luggage, and we handed the girls the plane tickets. Then they opened it up, and they saw Honolulu, Hawaii, and they both started crying. And it was a great experience. It was our first trip to Hawaii, and that was in 1976. Now, we'd been married for a few years, so we had a couple of kids at the time. But we didn't take our children. It was just the four of us. And we stayed right in Waikiki on Oahu in Honolulu. And when we got there, we were walking down Waikiki one day, and we happened to notice a little sign in a travel agency that said for $50 a person that they would fly you over to the island of Kauai and put you up for timeshare presentation. So we signed up for that, and we flew over to Princeville, Hawaii, which is on the north shore of Kauai. And we fell in love, and we stayed in a place called Pali Kaikoura, which now has kind of become our home away from home. We've been back there multiple times, and they've even sent one of our kids on his honeymoon there. But it's been great, great fun, and the island of Kauai has become, you know, really a very lot of fond memories. We probably have been to Hawaii every other year since 1976.
In 2013, Tom and Dorothy embarked on their next grand adventure, a mission to Perth, Australia. This required Tom to retire from his very successful career. They didn't realize it at the time, but it was actually a fulfillment of personal prophecy given to them by a stake president.
My journals are kind of a hit and miss, with the exception of when Dorothy and I were in Australia, and I was quite faithful at it. But I had started a journal back in 1988, and I went up through it about 1995. So as I was reading my journal, I came across when my first son, Michael, had been called to be a missionary. On December the 7th, 1987, tonight, the family went to President Tuller's office, where my son Michael was set apart as a missionary. And President Tuller gave him a beautiful blessing that I didn't write anything about the blessing. But what I did write down was that President Tuller said that one day Dorothy and I would serve a mission together. And I was absolutely amazed that almost 35 years ago, I'm looking back in my journal, completely forgotten about it, didn't say anything about what Michael's blessing was, but I did write down President Tuller saying that we were going on a mission. And of course, that was the last thing in our minds at that part in our lives. So in 2013, we had two of our very close friends in our ward here in the Union First Ward that were both called to be mission presidents. One was Alan Bork, who lived directly across the street from us, and the other one was Bruce Lindsay, who lives just about 100 yards away from us as the crow flies. Alan was called to be the mission president in Peru, and Bruce Lindsay was called to be the mission president in Perth, Australia. They both approached us and asked Dorothy and I if we would be interested in being a senior couple on their mission. With Alan Bork, his mission in Peru, neither one of us speak Spanish. And so it just turns out that we weren't very interested in going on a Spanish-speaking mission. The mission to Australia had a little bit more interest, and Bruce Lindsay had asked us on several occasions, and on July the 1st is when they start being a mission president. So they both left, and we had made no commitments. And about sometime in early September, I had been out on my morning walk, and when I came home, Dorothy said, Bruce Lindsay just called us today and said he needs a couple of senior missionaries, one to run the office to be his secretary and somebody to be the finance secretary. And he was wondering if we'd change our mind or if we'd given it any consideration. And so we thought about it for, close to 3 or 4 minutes. Before we made our decision, we said, let's do it. I was still working at the time. I was 73 at the time, so it was probably time for me to quit working. But we decided to go, and we absolutely loved the idea of going. But there was a lot of preparation to get ready to go on a mission. And one of the things was that you had to get a lot of shots, and you had to go down and have a clearance from your local police department to say that you were not a bad guy. And in order to get a visa for Australia, you had to submit a request to be cleared by the FBI to get a visa to go to Australia. Well, we made all these requests, and this goes back to 1958. In 1955, Disneyland in Southern California opened up. 3 years later, in 1958, and I just turned 18, and my brother and my friend Alan Eisenbach and my friend David Thaxter and I all decided that we wanted to go to Disneyland, but we didn't have any money. But one of our friends had told us that they knew how you could get into Disneyland for free by climbing over the fence in the jungle land. So that was our plan. So we went to Disneyland, and we climbed over the fence, and we were climbing through the jungles to get into the main park, and we got caught by the security, and we all got arrested. Now, my brother and Alan Eisenbach were under 18, and so they just released them to their parents. But my friend David Thaxter and I had just turned 18, and they were going to make an example out of us. And so they called the local Orange County police and charged us with trespassing. And the local police took us into the jail that night, and we spent the night in jail. And I called up my parents, and my mom and dad said, no, we're not going to come and bail you out. But my friend David Thaxter's mother was a lot more sympathetic. And so we went before the judge the next morning, and the judge fined us both $15, of which we didn't have. If we'd had $15, we would have paid to get into Disneyland. But his mother paid the fine, and we got out. Okay, so what does this have to do with the mission? Well, unbelievable to us was that, and no computers in those days, the FBI had records of our arrest. And they turned that in, and our visa had not come and did not come to go to Australia. Dorothy was convinced that we were not going on our mission because of her jailbird husband, but the visa finally came and had nothing to do with me getting caught at Disneyland. So we went, and we loved our mission. And President Lindsay and Sister Lindsay treated us just like family. And we made so many friends over there and loved every minute of every day. We became friends with all the young missionaries that came in. And our mission, it was a very large mission. Our mission went from the very southern part of Western Australia to the very northern part. It went from a town called Albany, Western Australia, all the way up to Broome. That would be like going from San Diego to Alaska. So it's a long, long mission. My job as a finance secretary when the young people came in was to give them information on how their mission was going to be financed. And they all had what would be called a debit card. And I would take care of that for them. And twice a month, I would put money onto the debit card. So I would tell them that if they ate out very often, that they would run out of money before the next two-week period came. But they were just kids. And so they would call me up and they would say, Elder Tall, I've run out of money and we don't have any food in the house. And can you please tell us when our next available money is coming into them? And I would always refer them to a scripture in the New Testament. No man knoweth the day or the hour. So they would laugh. But I got to know all the missionaries and loved them. And Dorothy knew all the missionaries. And we would start about 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and we would go till 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Many a day at 3 o'clock, I would walk into Dorothy's office and say, we haven't eaten yet. And that's how the days went. It was just so much work, and the days would go by so quickly, but we loved every minute of it.
And of course, it wouldn't be Australia if they didn't have a few run-ins with the wildlife there.
Every morning, I would get up early at 5:30 or 6 o'clock and go for about a 5 or 6 mile walk every morning. And one morning, it was still dark, and I was walking close to a park. And I looked to my left, and I saw this great big dog that was coming at me just in the corner of my eye. And when I turned to look at it, it turned out to be a big kangaroo that was just about right in my face. But the kangaroo was just as surprised as I was. He looked at me, and I looked at him, and he went his way, and I went my way. But so that's the only thing. And I have no love for snakes. Dorothy, she has no love for spiders. But in our driveway, we had the biggest spider that you could possibly imagine. And we became quite friends with that spider. It had a great big web alongside of a long driveway. And we would look at it every morning, and we never saw any snakes.
Through all his amazing travels, successes in work, a faithful mission, and more, Tom would say that he's most proud of his family.
I would say proudest accomplishment, seeing my sons, three sons serve on a mission because I had not served on a mission. That was pretty much of a highlight. My oldest boy went to Venezuela, Michael, and then my son Matthew went to France. And my youngest son, Marty, ended up going to Argentina. And so that was extremely gratifying. And the three boys have all just been terrific sons. We've loved them and they've done well. Our two daughters are both doing very well today. Our daughter, Michelle, lives in Southern California with her son. And our daughter, Megan, lives here with her husband in Salt Lake, and she's a registered nurse. And right now, all five of our children are doing just really well. So we're greatly blessed for that. One of the things that has been very gratifying to me is that the friends that I've made throughout my life, I've been able to maintain the friendship and keep in touch with them. And that has served me really well. I've had good friends all my life. The one thing that I have learned and that I've passed on to my children is that nothing stays the same forever. Be it good or bad, things are going to change. And so we've all had tough times in our life, and I tell my children and I tell Dorothy, you know, it's just temporary. Dorothy and I got married in the temple, so we have been active and we raised our children in the church from the time that we got married. But I was blessed with a testimony that I knew the church was true at a very young age. Even when I was doing some things that I probably shouldn't have done, thank heavens for repentance and the atonement, but I always knew it was true. And so it was not hard for me to take Dorothy to the temple and raise our children in the church. Dorothy and I have, from the time we've been married, have tried to raise the children in a home, a family home evening, and I've taught them. The gospel is everything to us. It's our whole life revolves around it. We both know that the church is true, that the plan of happiness and salvation is going to bring our family back eventually. It means everything to us. We go to the temple every week, and we get great solace from that, and we both have solid testimonies of the truthfulness of the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Tom Tall has been an incredible example of hard work and dedication. His amazing successes have been driven by love for his faith and his family. A big thanks to Tom and Dorothy Tall for purchasing this episode and for being interviewed. If there's someone you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.